Hi, I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of the Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode, episode number 69, is an Anglerfish podcast flashback. Today is part 8, Growing Pains, from eBay fraud to credit theft to tax return identity theft. Find out in this episode how I evolved as a cyber criminal. Enjoy. If you like it, subscribe. If you don't like it, subscribe. I need all the subscribers I can get. I'm trying to get to the point where, again, I'm able to bitch about whatever I want to without being beholden to corporate America. So please, if you like, subscribe. If you don't, subscribe and let me know what you like and don't like about the show. I always read the comments. I often or almost always respond to those comments as well. With that said, without further ado...
At the height of my criminal activity, I stole $160,000 every single week. Tax return identity theft. That's right. You ever wonder why your returns are delayed every single year and who is responsible for that? Look no further than the SOB talking to you right now. I got to where I could file a return once every 6 minutes. I would file returns from Sunday through Wednesday. Thursday, I would take a road trip, plot out a map of ATMs. Friday and Saturday, cash out. Turns out that $150,000 will fit in that type of backpack that you see thrown over the shoulders of kids as they go to and from high school and college. So I had $150,000 in a backpack. I would come home to Charleston, South Carolina. I had a spare bedroom. I would open up the door, chuck the backpack in. And I did that for 10 months out of every single year. So, Brett, how did you do that? Well, I'll tell you what. Let's give everyone a tutorial on tax return identity theft when I was committing it. That's right, let's make some money. Now, before we begin, there's a few things we need to know. First, we will be using the California Death Index. Access is free online. It comes with a person's name, the DOB, date of birth, the DOD, date of death, social security number, mother's maiden name, place of birth, and place of death. For fraudulent tax purposes, we only need the name, the date of birth, and the social security number. Quick heads up here. Prior to 1998, the only way the United States government knew if someone was dead was if the family of the deceased filed for a social security death benefit. Social security pays around $212 if the benefit is filed. It's supposed to help with burial expenses. Now, filing for that benefit is the only indication the federal government has of knowing if someone is dead. Prior to 1998, the family had to file for the benefit. After 98, the funeral home could file for it, the hospital could file for it, but 1998 and before that, that resulted in many families not filing for that benefit. Why did they not file, Brett? Well, it turns out they were too sad, too distraught. They didn't think it was enough money. They probably said to themselves, $212? Hell, you can't bury a goldfish for $212. So the result, the feds simply don't know that a lot of people are dead. Also, the California State Death Index is a state database. By law, the feds can't cross-reference a state index. The reasoning for that is pretty simple. Those state records, they're not 100% accurate. They're actually living people listed on the California State Death Index. Now, I'm sure you could imagine what kind of clusterfuck that would be if the feds started calling someone dead who ain't. The feds' inability to cross-reference the Cali Index and then the lack of people filing for that death benefit means that as far as the feds are concerned, all of those people are still alive. So what we need to do is we need to compile a list of dead people from the California Death Index. Now me, I like using the information of people who would just now be entering into adulthood. I always thought it makes it look like the person filing taxes just entered the workforce and they're so young and so vibrant and alive. So the only thing we need is the name, the social security number, and the date of birth. Nothing else. Next, we need to make sure that no one has filed for that aforementioned death benefit on our list of dead people. For that, we need to fire up the Social Security Death Index. That Social Security Death Index is a fairly complete index of everyone the U.S. government knows as dead. Access? Free. Online. You input the person's PII, the dead person's PII, the personal identifying information, into the Social Security Death Index. if a result comes back. The feds know the person is dead, and we cannot use them to file taxes. If no results are returned, cha-ching, that's a moneymaker. Yes! That list completed. Next, we need an employer identification number. No, not our own. We're going to use someone else's. After all, we are identity thieves. So, we head over to Google and we look for EIN directories or EIN lookups. Now, me, myself, I was always partial to a site called FreeERISA.com. So, head over there and we start pulling EIN numbers. Now, I don't like using big companies or retailers. I like small, local businesses. And whatever state you're saying the list of dead people live in, that employer needs to be in the same state, hopefully the same city. For example, if you say that Joe Napier, who died in 1997, lives at 122 Cottonwood Lane, Muncie, Indiana, then you need an employer from Muncie, Indiana. And I don't use charities or nonprofits. I just say use small local businesses. It works like a charm. Get yourself a list of 20 or 30 of these EINs, and hey, spread the EINs and the dead people out across several states. That way, law enforcement and tax processors can't flag one specific state as potential fraud. Now, for fraudsters, tax season runs from roughly January 15th through October 15th. I've said that before. Yes, filing deadline is April 15th, but the feds give two automatic extensions to anyone they owe a refund to. That first extension is mid-August, the second extension mid-October. So committing fraud runs from January through mid-October, 10 months. 10 months that you can make money using people's profiles to steal refunds. I just had to say it again because, you know what? I can go, cha-ching, yay! So now we have the list of names and the list of employers. Next comes the step of figuring out how much each refund should be. And I'm a firm believer of keeping it under $3,000 per return. Why? Well, the IRS doesn't pay as much attention to small dollar returns, so you get a lot more of them approved. Yes, you can file for a $10,000 refund, but there are some problems with that. First, it's a large amount. It's going to attract attention. Next, where are you going to have the deposit sent? And yes, you are going to deposit it because only an idiot has a check sent out. So where, pray tell, are you going to have it deposited? Surely not your own bank account. That's just asking for trouble. Don't believe me? Well, head your ass over to IRS.gov, that website, and read over some of the indictments. It's a good source to learn fraud. Also, a good source to learn how people get caught. A lot of the folks there actually got money, but they had it deposited to their actual accounts. What do we call those people? Idiots. All the cops had to do was see where the money went and then go knock on a door. Not bright. So, you're either going to have to set up a fake bank account, which is a lot of hard work and stress. I mean, are you going to walk into a bank with a fake driver's license? I don't think so. They got you on camera, all kinds of shit. Of course, you could set it up online using someone's stolen identity, but here's the problem with that. You've got to have a debit card. You've got to have that debit card sent someplace. Well, Brett, I could obviously have the debit card sent to that person's address and then steal it out of their mail. Yes, yes, you could. Are you brave enough to do that? You know what? I'm going to bet you're not, which means you're going to have that debit card sent to an alternate address, a drop address. Well, guess what? To have that card sent to that alternate address, that address needs to be on that victim's credit report. How do you get it on the credit report? Well, guess what? It's not the easiest shit in the world, so you gotta do that too. So are you gonna do all that? I don't think so. Fortunately, there is another way. Prepaid debit cards. Turns out, over 40% of all Americans are unbanked. Not to mention all those illegal aliens who cannot get bank accounts. A lot of those people, well, they tend to use prepaid debit cards. They're like virtual bank accounts. You can have your check deposited directly to them, or you can have a variety of government benefits sent to them, like, for example, tax refunds. The only problem is a lot of those cards have daily deposit limits. those limits tend to be either $2,500 or $3,000. Deposit any more than that, and there's a fairly decent chance your card will be blocked until you call in and explain things. You don't want that. You don't want any human looking at the cards or the deposits. Why? Well, if you get like me and you're filing a lot of income taxes, when I got to where I could file one again once every 6 minutes, one return per card, so I would maybe have 200 prepaid debit cards per week. You don't want a human being looking at those, so let's take a minute to break down that last statement that I made. In case it hasn't hit you yet, the biggest problem is getting enough deposit instruments so you can make enough money. Now, you can head down to Walmart and buy your ass a bunch of Green Dot debit cards. Sometimes they'll even work. But if you try to buy a couple of hundred Green Dots, people look at you a little funny. Sure, you can take a road trip and buy 3 to 5 cards at every location. But that's going to get tired pretty quick. And if you keep going to the same stores, people are going to remember you as that debit card guy. And you might be on camera. Bad, 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 bad idea. What I found that worked for me was to fire up Google again and search for quote-unquote payroll cards. They are basically prepaid debits, but meant for employees to use at companies they work for. Their paycheck deposited directly to them. If you're an employer, it's normal to order 200 to 300 of these things at a time. And they're instant issue, so the employer activates the cards with whatever name he wants attached to them. What do we call that? We call that fucking sweet. Sweeter still is that the payroll card providers will send the cards out to the employers free of charge. So all you gotta do is call up, tell the people you're an employer, give them some sop story about, well, you know what? I got a chicken farm out here. I got all these illegal immigrants and stuff working over here. I need some way to pay these people because you know what? I ain't gonna carry a bunch of cash and they can't get a check cashed because they ain't got no driver's license. Ain't you guys got some cards, some prepaid payroll cards you can send out to me? That's all you got to tell them. And it works like a charm. Hey, you ever notice how none of this has cost any money so far? Yeah, that's right. I like that kind of stuff too. So now we got everything we need. Now we got to figure out the exact dollar returns. Now you can use payroll software or you can just plug in numbers using the withholding percents of the IRS. We're filing taxes online, so we don't need actual copies of W-2s or anything like that. For online filing, when you do fill out the W-2s, you only need to worry about 6 fields other than the name and address crap. And those 6 fields are the Medicare income, federal income, Social Security income, and the federal withholding, Medicare withholding, Social Security withholding. Just those 6. Leave everything else blank except for name, address, employer, ADDIE, EIN, social. That's it. And here's the deal. You're likely going to have a lot of prepaid cards from one specific bank. So if you're like me and you file 200 returns a week and 80% of them fund, that means the bank is going to get 160 tax refunds going to a certain set of prepaid cards with deposits very, very similar. Fortunately, the deposits are automated. If a human saw that shit, believe you me, they would think it a bit strange. Not a computer. We like that. We like it when a computer looks at things. So as long as we don't do anything stupid, no one will notice anything about the cards until most of the money is withdrawn. And how much money is that, Brett? Well, for me, okay, I file 200 returns a week. 80% of those returns are accepted and refunds deposited to those. So that's 160 cards, close to $2,500 on each card. So let's say it's $2,300 to be fair. $2,300 times 160 equals $368,000 a week. Now, not all weeks are like that. The problem being that you always have trouble finding enough cards, but I would routinely withdraw $160,000 a week of the government's money. So, now it's filing time. Head on over to the IRS website and see who's there offering free e-file. Now, we aren't going to file state taxes, only federal. Why? Because a lot of tax prep places online will do federal for free, but charge for state filing. And we aren't looking to spend a lot of money here if we can help it. Myself, I always preferred H&R Block and Tax Act. True professionals over there who offer quick, streamlined tax filing systems. I can file return manually every 6 minutes. Basically, it's just a 1040 EZ. I'm not going to itemize. I'm not going to claim extra dependents or any of that crap. Just file single, take the standard deduction, rinse, repeat. Recycle the employer info, the earnings info. The only thing that changes is the victim name and the deposit information. Wait for a few days, check the IRS website to make sure the return was accepted, then wait and see when it's scheduled to deposit. Deposit day? Well, if you've got a shitload of cards, you want to be prepared. First, funds are going to hit the cards around 3 a.m. of the scheduled date. I don't like to wait until mid-morning to start withdrawing. I like to start withdrawing just as soon as that money is available. I mean, hey, something could happen. You could sleep until 9 a.m. and then go try to withdraw. Well, by that point, some nosy person at the card company may have looked at it and frozen all your cards. All that money, all that work, lost. And here, let me tell you, it's happened to me. So get your ass out of bed. And here's another thing. 160 cards, that's a lot of fucking cards. You're going to need to hit multiple ATMs. You don't want to be out at 3 a.m. in the morning looking for cash machines. So sometime prior to deposit date, you need to drive around and find 10 or 15, maybe 20 of these machines. You actually need to plot a route you're going to take to withdraw currency. Why? Because withdrawing funds from 160 cards takes a lot of fucking time. You don't want to waste more time not knowing where you're going. Now me, in my life, I've ran at least two ATM machines out of cash that I still remember. One had $19,000 in it, the other one had $23,000. So please, be advised, have multiple machines ready to use. Okay, some bad news. Those prepaid debits, they do have withdrawal limits. Sometimes those limits may be $400 a day. Sometimes they may be $1,500 a day, or even whatever is on the card. If you get some of the low limit withdrawal cards, then you're going to have to withdraw $400 on them on Friday, then another $400 at 12:01 a.m. Saturday morning, then another $400 at 12:01 Sunday morning, then again on Monday morning. You want to try to get the money out as soon as possible, because believe you me, come Monday or Tuesday, someone, somewhere, is going to know something is going on. And here's my final piece of advice. Please, for the love of God, have something to put the fucking money in.
Welcome to the Anglerfish Podcast, where we visit the darkest corners of our online lives. I'm your host, Brett Johnson. The United States Secret Service called me the original Internet Godfather. Now, what does it take to get a title like that? 39 felonies, a place on the United States Most Wanted list, an escape from prison, and I built the first organized cybercrime community, Shadow Crew. Shadow Crew was a precursor to today's darknet and darknet markets, and it laid the foundation for the way modern cybercrime channels still operate today. This first season of the Anglerfish Podcast tells of my rise and fall as the world's first internet godfather. It's a fascinating story. You'll learn how cybercriminals think, how modern cybercrime came into being, and why it's so successful and hard to stop, and how I was able to turn from a life of crime to one of using the knowledge I acquired as a criminal to help protect others against the type of person I used to be.
Where did you go to college in Kentucky, Brett?
So where I was on, where did I go to college? I was on the 7-year program. So right? 7-year bachelor degree, that's me. So I started out
So I graduated high school at a place called Dilscombe's. When I graduated as the top actor and actress in the state. I actually won both awards.
Actress, too. Well, how'd you manage that?
Well, the thing was, is we were at state competition. We did Neil Simon's The Good Doctor was the name of the show. When they gave out the awards that night, the guy stands up and he was like, look, he's like, there was no really good female actors, so we're going to give both awards. So I got the best actor and actress for that was 1989 was the year I won that. And I'm to this day, I'm still the only guy in Kentucky who won best actor and actress in the state. So I got that, and I had a lot of scholarships coming out of high school, you know, for Berea, Rhodes College, a few other things. Didn't take them because I had found my first girlfriend, that Christy girl I told you about, and I was just infatuated with her. That's my story, Ken, as I've always wanted. You know, it's all about love, man. It's that's the most important thing. I don't care about anything else. I just want somebody to love me.
I get it. And next to religions and life insurance, it's probably the one of the greatest intangible markets out there.
Oh yeah. So I went to the community college in Hazard, Kentucky. It was called Hazard Community College. And I told you the last time we talked that I did a B&E for this baseball card shop, right? Well, I went home and it hit me that that was not the first breaking and entering that I did. Oh, no, my friend. You see, I was committing crime under my mom. I branched out on my own. And what I did was I was at Hazard Community College and I saw all these Apple Macs, the Mac 2 pluses and all that they had. And I was like, I wonder if I could get one of those and sell it. Well, back then they had that big Computer Shopper magazine. You remember those?
Oh, I remember, yeah. Before the internet.
That was it, yeah. So I went through the back of that, and it had several places that would buy used computers. So what happened was is I was doing theater at that community college. I hid in the stage room, the prop room, until everyone left the college that night, got out, and stole computers. From the inside out. They didn't have any alarm system or anything else, and stole a Mac 2, a PC, a laptop, and a big dot matrix printer. And that was the first real breaking and entering that I did at that point. And I've done so much crime, I didn't even remember it until I went home after talking to you the last time.
All right. So you stole these computers and you sold them to this company?
Called the company up, told them what I had. They were like, I think it was like $1,500 is what they gave me for it. I was like, yes, we'll ship those out. Well, the shipping on the damn stuff was like $200. that was it. And I went to that school for, I was majoring in literature and theater was what I was majoring in at the time. But I was just a rogue, man.
No kidding. Right. I'm glad you're recovering.
Well, that's the thing, right? Recovering. It's always recovering.
All right. So where we left off, you were telling me about the of course the mangy elephant.
Oh yeah.
And you talked a little bit about some satellite issues.
Right.
300 channels as seen on TV.
Exactly.
It is TV.
So that right there, the Beanie Baby was really the first real cybercrime I committed. But what led into this whole thing of the cybercrime structure we see today kind of began with these satellite cards, these programmed cards that were turning on all the channels for people. So what was happening was, like I said last time, I was doing pirated software that turned into pirated games and led into mod chips for gaming systems, then mod chips for cable systems, and then all of a sudden I'm programming the cards on these 18-inch satellite RCA systems to turn on the channels too. Well, about that same time, up in Canada, this judge up there, don't know what he was smoking, but this judge up there, he rules that it was legal for Canadian citizens to pirate those satellite DSS signals. And his entire logic was, since RCA doesn't sell in Canada, it's okay for my citizens to pirate that signal. So that led to overnight, a couple of days. But you could go down to Best Buy, you'd buy an RCA system for $99, you'd take it out in the parking lot rip it open, you'd pull the card out, throw the system, you'd actually just leave the system in the buggy, take the card, program it, ship it to Canada, $500 a pop.
Ah.
Yeah. So I started doing that, had tons of business. I was at that point in time, you could sell those cards on eBay. eBay didn't have any rules against it or anything else. So I was selling all that I could on eBay, had so many orders I couldn't keep up with them all. And the straw that broke the camel's back, this one gentleman from Canada, he sends me an order. He wants 10 cards. Well, I'm not about to go buy 10 systems at Best Buy. So I was sitting there going, you know, he's in Canada. I'm down here. Who the hell is he going to complain to? So I was like, yeah, dude, I'll do your 10 cards. So he sends me a cashier's check. Of course, I cash the cashier's check. I don't send the cards up. And at that point, it occurs to me, I don't need to send any cards. I'll just start stealing all the money that I can. So start doing that. And I guess I was bringing in $3,000 to $5,000 a week just doing that. Got scared because I was like, that's a lot of money to go into a bank account. Somebody somewhere is going to start looking at me.
Yep.
So I was like, okay, what I need to do is get a fake driver's license. Use that fake driver's license, go down to Fifth Third Bank, open up a bank account in that name, and launder all the money through that. Just withdraw it through the ATM machine.
Nobody will ever detect that.
Oh, no, nobody would see that at all. Yeah, I was not very sophisticated. So I was at UK. Of course, you'd think you'd know where to get a fake ID. Not a clue, man, not a clue. So I get online, start looking around. I mean, I spend hours just trying to find where I can find a fake ID. Finally, I find this website. It was ran by this dude that called himself Fake ID Man. And he offered all 50 states, said they were pristine, could not tell the difference between any of them, anything else like that. So I was like, oh, that's what I need right there. So I sent him $200 by Western Union, sent him my picture. He rips me off. Yeah.
Oh, it made you mad, I bet.
Oh, right, dude. I was so pissed, I couldn't stand it. You know, I was used to ripping people off, not being the victim. So I get angry, but the problem is that I still need that driver's license. That was the issue. So he can rip me off all he wants, but I still need a driver's license. So I keep looking around, and I find this website called Counterfeit Library. And that website, the only thing it dealt with, it sold counterfeit degrees. They were coming in and out of Hong Kong. And they had a forum on there that was completely defunct. I mean, no traffic on it whatsoever. That was the only website that dealt with anything at that time that was even marginally related to cybercrime. That was it. If you were looking to commit cybercrimes before that, you had IRC, this internet relay chat thing. So
right,
that's the only thing you had, which was horrible. You didn't know if you were getting ripped off. You couldn't talk to anybody. It was all bullshit. So that was the only real website that was out. I start going to that forum. I'm the first person on the forum, and the only thing I'm doing is complaining. That's it, just bitching day in, day out. I don't have anything else to do. The next two people, there's a few other people that start trickling in. The two most important people was a guy who went by the screen name of Beelzebub. He was from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. And then there's another guy that went by the screen name of Mr. X, and he was from Los Angeles. So me and Beelzebub got to be really good friends, you know, chatting every day, and I would complain, and he would just kid with me and everything else. After about 2 weeks of me just constantly complaining, he gets me on ICQ, this messaging service, sends me a message, and I went by the screen name Gollum Fun at that point. And, of course, it's a Lord of the Rings thing, right?
And I was going to ask you because I didn't read Lord of the Rings.
Okay. That's what it was, and I'll tell you how stupid that name is. When I was selling satellite cards, my screen name on eBay and on all these other satellite forums was Baggins Dad, was what it was. So I figured if I was going to be engaged in cybercrime, I couldn't use Baggins Dad because they would associate it with me. But I still liked the Lord of the Rings, so I'm like, okay, not Baggins Dad. How about Gollum Fun? Yeah, it's nothing smart about it at all, right? But Beelzebub gets me on ICQ. Sends me a message. He's like, Gollum, I can make you an ID. And I'm like, you can you? He's like, yeah, I can make you one. I was like, well, make me one. Send it over. And he's like, no, I'm going to charge you $200 for it. And I'm like hell you are. He's like, I'm going to charge you $200, and you're going to pay it. And I'm like, dude, you're out of your fucking mind. So he's like, and he pauses, and he was like, look, man, he said, if you're going to do this as a business, you are going to have to trust people.
You have to do that. He said, so I'm going to charge you $200, and you're going to pay me the $200, and I'm going to send you that ID. And it got me so bad, I was like, you know what? And by this point, I'm friends with the people who actually own Counterfeit Library. I was like, I'll tell you what. I'm going to send you $200. That way, when you rip me off, I can get your ass booted off this website. And I don't have to look at you anymore. So I sent him $200, sent him that passport photo. 2 weeks later, I get an Indiana State driver's license. Name is Stephen Schwecki was the guy's name. Real guy, worked at ADP Payroll, to this day works at ADP Payroll. And I thought that that driver's license was the prettiest thing I'd ever seen.
Because it had your picture.
Had my picture, somebody else's name on it. And I was not, the thing was, is I was not educated on fake documents at that point. I didn't know what was good and what wasn't. Now, looking back, that was a marginal driver's license. It was not pristine, all right? If you look at driver's licenses, the way that they were created back then, in order to make a fake one, you would either have to steal a real driver's license or get someone to send you a driver's license. Then you'd sit down with Photoshop, and you'd have to create a template by hand. A lot of the times you'd have to create the fonts as well, spend hours doing this, maybe a couple weeks just doing the template, all right? Then once you've got the template, what are you going to print it on? Are you going to do PVC? Well, if you do PVC, guess what? You got to have a PVC card printer. That's either a Data Card or a Fargo. Those are $2,500 a pop minimum. How do you get them? Well, guess what? Both Data Card and Fargo know they're used for fake driver's licenses, so you have to go through all these checks, references, everything else to get the damn thing. So that's usually out for most people. Most people are not going to spend $2,500 on a printer and then try to pass the verification checks. So what they do instead, back then, you'd get a piece of Teslin. You'd go down to the art store, buy a sheet of Teslin, this clear paper. You'd print the template on that, put it between two sheets of laminate, laminate it. When the heat hits it and it's laminated, that Teslin turns opaque, turns hard, kind of, sort of, maybe, possibly mimics PVC. And that's what they were. That's what most driver's licenses were printed on. So the problem with that was is that you didn't have access to all 50 states. Not only that, but you've got the hologram to worry about. Back then, we didn't have multi-spectrum holograms, but you still needed them. So what you'd do is you'd head your ass back to the art store, buy gold interference, and hand make a hologram that kind of, sort of, maybe, if you squinted properly in the dark, would kind of maybe look like multi-spec hologram. And that was it. But all because of that, you couldn't use the same fake driver's license in the state it was issued in, nothing like that. And we sold those things for $300 a piece like they were going out of style. So that's what he had made, was this Teslin ID with a gold spec hologram, everything else. It was marginal. Compared to the driver's licenses of today, it was horrible, just horrible. But I got that, and I was stupid enough to think that it would pass anywhere. So what do? I load up and I use it to set up bank accounts. I launder counterfeit checks through these check cashing places. You know, so they take the driver's license, they run the driver's license, everything else. I was just stupid enough to walk in and see if it'd work, and it did. Okay. And started doing all that. And that's what kind of begins here, is Beelzebub was making the IDs. Turned out that Mr. X, he made a very passable Social Security card, because you go down to Walgreens, buy this academic sketch pad. That sketch pad, it looks exactly like the background on a Social Security card. So you just cut it out, use that as print paper. So he started making that. I didn't have any knowledge at all about any of this stuff. So Beelzebub, he was like, he wanted to sell the IDs. And he was like, I'll tell you what. He said, Mr. X will sell. Why don't you be the reviewer? That way you get access to every single thing that comes in. You learn how they work, learn what's good, everything else. And that way you can educate yourself. And I'm like, let's do it. And that was, it was kind of like Field of Dreams for criminals. If you build it, they will come.
Yep.
We started doing that. And the thing was, no one had ever seen anything like that. You know, you had IRC where you could talk about scams and trying to buy some identities, and it was always a failure. with Counterfeit Library, with that forum, and I talked to the owners over there, and they gave me full reign of the forum. With Counterfeit Library over there, we had a vouching system. If I reviewed something, people knew that I had received the product. Not only that, but my review carried weight because Beelzebub and I had talked about it. So if I reviewed a product, if you bought from that person that I reviewed and he ripped you off, I was then responsible for reimbursing you for whatever you had lost. And that's what I would do. And that's one of the ways that I built such a strong name within that entire community. And Counterfeit Library became so popular at that point. People knew they could trust the site. So it really established this kind of trust mechanism that criminals could use. They now had a place where they could engage with other criminals and not be ripped off. And that's what started this entire thing that we still see today.
What happened to Counterfeit Library?
Funny you should ask. So the thing with Counterfeit Library, like I said, the website itself dealt with degree mills and counterfeit college certificates and everything, right? The problem was that at that point in time, this is in the late 1990s, early 2000s. At that point in time, we started to see this big movement for distance learning legitimately. You know, you had Phoenix University, you had all these other colleges that started to offer online degrees, all right? One of the big guys, one of the big proponents for that was a guy, I think his name was John Engle. He used to appear on Good Morning America talking about how great distance learning was and everything else. Well, he gets wind of Counterfeit Library, of them offering counterfeit degrees. He gets pissed. And what happens is, so on the forum side of things, part of the reason I was able to run that, we had a deal that I could do whatever I wanted to with that forum, but at the same time, there had to be a sub-forum that was talking about degree mills, certificates, job verifications, all of that stuff. So I agreed to that. Well, John Engle didn't get mad at the credit cards and the stolen identities. What he got mad about was the degrees. So he had a huge following. He had a forum of his own with, you know, tens of thousands of members. He posts over on his forum about our website, about how we are destroying distance learning. His members start coming to Counterfeit Library and just doing nothing but flooding the forum so that we couldn't even conduct business. Now, what had happened before that, we had been dealing, Counterfeit Library, it specialized initially in eBay fraud, PayPal fraud, fake driver's licenses, that degree of identity theft, all right, of trying to post things that you didn't have, sell them, things like that. The way that we got into credit card fraud, now Counterfeit Library had been up for maybe a year, year and a half. I didn't know it, but this guy by the name of Dmitry Golubov over in the Ukraine, he had been looking at Counterfeit Library, and he really liked what he saw. What he does is he calls all of his buddies in Ukraine. They call their buddies. They end up having a conference, a criminal conference in Odessa, where they all meet, they talk about Counterfeit Library, and how they would like to build a site of their own. And that site turns out to be a site called Carter Planet, because the Ukrainians at that point had a shitload of credit card data. Script himself, that was Dmitry Golubov, he was a spammer. He was getting all this credit card information in, and he wanted to sell it. He thought he could make a living selling stolen credit card numbers. Didn't know it for sure yet, but he had a good idea that it would work. So they end up building Carter Planet. The problem was, and I talk about this a lot in presentations today, in order for cybercrime to be successful, three things have to happen. You have to gather data, you have to commit the crime, and then you have to be able to cash it out. Yep. If you can't put cash in pocket, you are useless in this. The problem with Ukraine, they couldn't put cash in pocket. Every single card on the planet was shut down for the Eastern Bloc of Europe. Even if you were the legitimate card owner, you could not run your card in the Ukraine or that eastern part of Europe at all. It was all shut down because of the amount of fraud that had already been hit. So Script, what he does is one day, he shows up on Counterfeit Library. And he makes one post, and that post is, hey, I've got credit card data. Give me a drop address, and a drop address is just an address where you can receive product. He's like, give me a drop address, give me a burner phone number, wait 5 business days, you can order whatever you want. Well, that right there, nobody had ever seen that before. The response from the members of Counterfeit Library was, bullshit. That's not possible. Not going to happen. You have to be a cop. You're trying to send us all to prison. You're just wanting our addresses. Well, that went crazy. I mean, that went insane at that point. To the point that I let it go on for over a week. And I mean, it was constant. He would try to come on and say something. They would just bombard him. So I finally got, I was like, okay, I've had enough of this shit. Get him on ICQ, because that's what we all use was ICQ. Get him on ICQ, and I'm starting to talk to him. I'm like, hey, man, if you're going to sell anything on Counterfeit Library, you have to be reviewed. And he's like, reviewed? What are you talking about? And I was like, look, in the United States, it's not like it is over there. If you're going to do anything for U.S. people, they have to know you're legitimate. See, Script didn't have that problem because they all physically knew everyone else on Carter Planet. But on Counterfeit Library, no one had ever met anybody else. So we had to have a review system in order to make sure everything was proper. The Ukrainians didn't need that. So Script was like, okay, review. What do I need to do? And I was like, I'll give you a drop address. I'll give you the phone number, and I'll make the order. He's like, okay, shoot. So I give him an address, give him a phone number, wait 5 business days, go to hitdell.com, and try to hit Dell for $5,000. And the order fails. I'm like, okay. Get back on ICQ. I'm like, hey, man, didn't work. He was like, give me one more chance. I'm like, okay, I'll tell you what. I'm going to give you one more chance, but if it doesn't work, that's your ass. And he was like, one more chance. I'm like, okay. So, give him another drop address, another phone number, wait 5 business days again. Meanwhile, the forum continues to go crazy. I've not told anybody I'm reviewing him. Forum continues to go crazy. 5 business days later, I hit Thompson's Computer Warehouse for $4,000. Dell.com for $5,000, shipped overnight, and it arrives at that drop address. I go and post the review the same day, and that was like wildfire. That was literally overnight. We transitioned from an eBay fraud type forum to a credit card theft forum immediately. Everyone goes crazy on it because my word at that point was bond. If I said something that was a moneymaker, people went to it like just hotcakes, man. So we started doing that. Script ends up bringing not only himself doing the credit card data, he brings this guy named Roman Vega, who went by the screen name of Boa. Boa sold physical credit cards and credit card dumps. So dumps are the magnetic information that goes on the stripe on the back of the card.
Right.
So he was selling those. I became Boa's only United States seller of those things. Yeah. And that story, I'll tell you, just to kind of segue before we talk about how Counterfeit Library kind of ended, but I was Boa's main seller, the only U.S. seller that he had. He gets to the point, me and him, we're all friends. At one point, I was going on safari with these guys, everything else. But we're all friends, we're all stealing a lot of money, everything else. Roman, Boa, he wants to send me, or he sends me a message one day that he wants to send me a counterfeit passport. He wants to get in the passport game. Now, I'm in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm like, shit, man, that's a moneymaker. Let's do that. Well, I trust the guy, right? So I give him a drop address. I was living on the Ashley River at that point in time in Charleston. I give him a drop address 2 blocks away because I trust the guy, all right? Empty house. It's a DHL delivery. I've got the tracking number. I know exactly what time DHL is supposed to be at that drop address. I go to the drop address. Now, as I'm driving out of the neighborhood, I pass by. DHL hasn't arrived yet, so I go down to a shopping complex to wait the 30 or 45 minutes until DHL is supposed to be there. Come back that 30 or 45 minutes later, at the drop address, there's probably 20 cars, police cars, parked out there.
Ah.
Yeah. It was all set up to try to get Brad Johnson. Turns out that Roman had been arrested in Cyprus. Nobody knew it. So here I am. Oh, shit. So I just drive by slowly, you know, do the gawking thing and don't worry about it and don't contact Roman anymore. A few weeks later, Script tells me that Roman's been arrested. So the reason, what happens with Counterfeit Library, back to that, John Engel, he starts having all of his members flood the forum. The way the Counterfeit Library forum was set up, we didn't have any moderators at all, whatsoever. A guy named Seth Sanders, he was an ID maker, a fake ID maker. He made a Michigan ID, a couple others, and he was very good. He made a very competent ID. He was disgusted with credit card theft. He thought that fake IDs were an art. He wanted to just concentrate on that. He didn't want to steal money from people. So he comes to me one day, and he was like, hey, Gollum, do you mind if I go off and create a website that just deals with fake IDs? And I'm like, man, do you. Whatever you want to do, I'll send all the ID makers over there. I don't care, man. Do you. So he goes off and builds ShadowCrew.com. His problem was nobody wanted, the only way they wanted fake IDs was to support the credit cards they were stealing.
Yeah.
So he gets like 60 members total to Shadow Crew at that point in time. Meanwhile, we're getting flooded to beat all hell on Counterfeit Library. And this lasts for 4 to 6 weeks, just constant, man. I mean, business is being hurt, everything else.
Now, by being flooded, you mean the Engel is having all of his people post fake reviews?
Fake messages, fake reviews, yeah. Just bombing the message board. So you can't figure, you can't even, like the real business links are 4 pages deep. Because you've got the first 3 pages of just bullshit. And that's it.
Yeah.
So I'm getting tired of it because the way the forum's set up, we don't have moderators. Seth is over there at Shadow Crew. He doesn't have any traffic whatsoever. He comes back to me and he's like, hey, Gollum, why don't you move everyone over to Shadow Crew? We've got sub forums. We've got moderators, super admins, everything like that. He said, I don't have any traffic. And I was like, you know what? I said, I'll tell you what. I'll move over there. You make me super admin. You give me permission to make whatever sub-forums I want, put whoever I want in charge, and we'll make it happen. And he was like, done. 48 hours later, Counterfeit Library's forum is shut down. Everybody has migrated to Shadow Crew. And that was the beginning of Shadow Crew right there.
In an organized fashion.
Very organized. Yeah, because again, I was at one point, Ken, I had my hand in every single transaction that took place on Counterfeit Library. If someone was doing business, I knew who they were doing business with, what they were buying, how much they were buying it for, everything else. Everything went through me. The problem, of course, was becoming that traffic was getting so high, couldn't do it all. So I had to rely on other moderators, everything else at that point in time. But yeah, it was just, I got to the point, you know, today I'm concentrated on being the guy that's not remembered as the guy who stole everything. I don't want to be remembered as that. I want to be the guy that turned things around, right? And, you know, with me, it was, that became my life. I didn't have friends. I didn't have anything like that. My friends were these other criminals because we at least associated with each other at that point.
Well, Brett, I'm always going to remember you as the guy who stole things.
Oh, yeah.
But the guy who turned things around educated me on how to keep myself safe.
Well, yeah.
And it's an ongoing thing.
It is.
And it will be ongoing through the rest of your career.
Well, you know, that's the thing is I didn't...
Saving the day. Da-da-da-da. Yeah.
You know, with me, I didn't realize, I don't think any of us really knew what we were building at that point. There were problems there, and as the problems popped up, you know, the being able to trust each other, as you get big, how do you scale up so it's not just one person that does everything, but a group of people or a system. So as the problems popped up is when we started to solve those problems at that point by having review systems, by having escrow systems, and establishing that trust mechanism using a forum structure, things like that. So it was all about solving those problems as we came on. We didn't know, you know, I don't think any one of us knew that cybercrime was going to be, you know, a $50 billion a year industry of just committing crime. Not only that, but you've got the security professionals that make billions of dollars a year trying to combat cybercrime. I mean, it's really the fastest growing crime on the planet. And it kind of started right there.
You know, I had a very good friend up in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, many, many years ago. He's no longer with us. His name was Dawson Wimsatt. Owned a tobacco store, one of the greatest cigar shops in the world, okay, as far as I'm concerned.
had the largest inventory of Dunhill pipes. Now, that's beside the point. But business is still business, okay?
Right, right.
And he had a legitimate business. He used to own a chain of crispy chicken restaurants that stretched from Indiana to Florida.
So how many did he own?
I have no idea how many he owned.
Okay.
He and his wife, Kay, would travel in a motorhome.
Gotcha.
And they would just make their rounds to all the restaurants and check them out. He told me several things that were valuable pieces of information and advice over the years. One was, and this one always sticks with me, if you have a restaurant or you have any kind of business and you want to open a second location,
right,
open at least two more instead of one.
So why?
So you're forced to hire somebody else to manage, because you can't manage two restaurants. You can't manage two convenience stores. So you've got to learn to trust people, and you've got to take that
risk.
Oh,
that's wild. Yeah, that's wild, because we had... So, you know, at one point, like I said, I was doing every single bit of business there. If someone was ripped off, and the way I ran things on Shadow Crew, not Shadow Crew, but Counterfeit Library, the way I ran things there, like I said, I vouched for someone. So if I vouched for someone, that means I took responsibility for that person. If that person goes on to rip someone off, that falls back on me to reimburse anyone that lost money. And I live by that. But at the same time, here's the funny thing about that. If someone came in and ripped a member off, yeah, I would reimburse that person that got ripped off. But at the same time, I would go back to the person that ripped the guy off and try to get him rehabilitated and back into the community. Because my thought process was, if you can rip off one of our members, you must know something. So let's get you back in the fold. Now, if I can get you back in the fold, are you going to behave yourself at that point? And more often than not, they would, all right? But you're right. It kind of comes into this chicken guy you're talking about, because as we continued to grow with that, I couldn't keep doing that. I mean, we were dealing with so much credit card data. So many people were coming in. I mean, just tons and tons of new members almost on a daily basis. I mean, we were, at one point, I think we were getting 1 million hits a week, just on people coming in, buying, reading, everything else. And you cannot, there's no way one person can handle all that traffic. So that became this idea as we transitioned over to Shadow Crew. My thing was, is how do you delegate that? How do you get to the point where it's not just me that's reviewing everything? And to be honest with you, I was getting scared, because I knew that at some point law enforcement was going to start looking. So if they start looking, it's pretty easy to figure out where I am, because I'm going to give you a drop address that I'll be to pick up an item. So I didn't want to keep doing that. So I'm like, okay, how do I delegate authority at that point? And that leads into what you're saying. I mean, you cannot, once you get so big, you can't run two businesses.
That's right.
You can't, you know, handle 1 million people coming into a website a week, just one person. You know, nowadays you've got all these systems that do that for you. But back then it was just Brett Johnson that was doing that. So it was all about delegating.
So when you transitioned into Shadow Crew, you had your minions.
You a lot had, of minions.
Let's not say minions. that conjures negative, connotations there. Let's say you had people.
I had people. And I'll tell you the best, Peter Taylor out of the UK, he gave the best comparison as to what that actually ran like. So I was the head of that. But at the same time, it was kind of like a co-op. It wasn't really a corporation. It was more of a co-op. People coming in, coming out. Of course, you had the head guy that kind of oversaw everything. That was me. But really, it was more co-op type structure all the time. People would partner with people. People move in, out, everything. It was very, very flowing with everything that was going on. So what I did was, is I kept thinking, okay, how do you go about, instead of me just reviewing somebody, you can have a system of reviews. And what I came up with, I was like, okay, I've already got moderators in place. Those moderators are with the credit forum or the ID forum or the fake degree forum, things like that. So whatever that moderator is, he or she will do the review. Now, how do you structure the review? So with credit cards, what I did was, is I said, okay, if you're selling credit card data, you should have enough credit card data to be able to supply my reviewer with 20 credit card numbers. He will run through those 20 credit cards. If he makes money off of those 20 credit cards, he will then pay you, the seller, for that credit card data. If he doesn't make money, well, then you're not going to be selling here anyway. So that my thought on that, and I used to say this all the time, was that if a seller, if a person is engaged in crime, he will continue to supply a product or service as long as it's viable for him to do so. Once it becomes not viable, he stops. Now, not viable can be he gets arrested, he gets scared, he runs out of product, any number of things like that.
Sure.
But until that point, he's going to provide that service for you. And that turned out to be true except for everybody except the Nigerians of all people. They would have the product, they just wouldn't provide it. So they would actually pass the reviews, but then they wouldn't provide the product to people, which became insanity all of a sudden. But other than those people, that held true, and that still holds true today. If you have a seller out there of credit card data, stolen identities, bank logins, PayPal logins, whatever the hell it is, drugs, he or she will continue to provide that product or service as long as it's viable for him to do that. All right? So, and that's what we understood then. That still goes on today. So that was the review system that was set up. At the same time, we didn't have cryptocurrency back then. We didn't have Bitcoin, anything else like that. We had e-gold, and a thing called Liberty Reserve came online after that. We tried to institute an escrow type system so that we would hold money. If someone really was not trusting the seller, we would say, send us the money. We'll hold the money for you. Once you get the product, at that point, we'll give the seller the money. If you don't get the product, guess what? Don't worry about it. Of course, the problem with that is sometimes the buyers would lie, and you'd have to figure out what was going on from there. But that's how the system ran at that point.
Well, Brett, being your next-door neighbor, I mean, and I yours, we've developed a fast friendship in the last couple of years, and this is terrific. I enjoy chatting with you, especially when we can have a little time to ourselves. But there's one thing that I'd really like to know is while you were doing the Shadow Crew thing, what was your personal life like?
Oh, geez, Ken. The personal life of a criminal, right? And there really is no personal life. I mean, I was lying to everybody. You know, I didn't have friends because you don't have friends when you're a criminal because you have associates. And I was my time on a computer daily was 14 to 16 hours. That's how much time I was every single day, 7 days a week. I was 14 to 16 hours on a computer. My wife, I was married to Susan for 9 years and pretty much lied to her the entire nine. It took her 3 years to find out I was a criminal. The next 6 years were me saying, I've stopped, I will stop, I'm going to stop. Susan got to the point, she knew I was a criminal. And she liked spending the money. She liked that. At the same time, I have to say this for her, she had a much better moral compass than I had. I didn't mind. It wasn't bothering me. I was able to compartmentalize everything at that point. So I wasn't really concerned. I kept telling myself, I'm not stealing from people. I'm stealing from banks. I'm stealing from governments. That's how I justified it.
Fighting the system.
I'm not stealing from the little man, just the big guys. And they can afford it, was what I told myself. And that was a lie, of course, but you have to justify what you're doing. So, my personal life, it was filled with lies, with just going nowhere. I mean, I didn't have a personal life at all. I was just worried about stealing money. And one of the things I found out going through prison, the addicts, and I was an addict at that point of crime, of being online and committing these crimes. But an addict, the only thing an addict loves is the drug. That's it. The addict cannot, and I was the same way, the addict cannot love anything but the addiction. The addiction comes first and foremost. So I put that above my wife, my family, everything else that was going on. And it took me years to realize that. Just years to really understand and accept, because I kept telling myself, oh, I'm doing it for my wife, I'm doing it for, you know, my family, I'm doing it for all these other people. But no, it took years for me to understand, no, I did it, I committed crime because I chose to commit crime.
right, so that was episode number 69 of the Brett Johnson Show, the Anglerfish Podcast Flashback Part 8, Growing Pains. I want to thank you guys for taking the time to tune in. I can't really tell you how much I appreciate that, how grateful and thankful I am for you to take the time to listen to me. If you like the show, please do subscribe. If not, hey, please do subscribe. Let me know what you like and don't like. Let me know what you want to hear me talk about or bitch about, and I'll make sure I get that in as well. Again, thank you guys for tuning in. I do appreciate it. As we close, what do we say? Stay safe, stay secure, and stay vigilant. More importantly, this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. Until next time, I'm Brett Johnson. Take care.